Hey everyone, it's Craig with the Slycast. And in addition to Slycast, I've been involved with a couple of different podcasts. You know, the one that me, Doug, and Ryan did on a monthly basis here before the network really took off. But I also did a podcast called Big Screen Book Club. And I wanted to share a couple episodes of that show here on this feed because I think if you're listening to this feed, you'll get a kick out of it. So basically, on Big Screen Book Club, what I did was I would take a movie and then the book that it was based on, and I'd have a special guest on each episode to sort of have a discussion about the differences, what we liked about the book, what we liked about the movie, and ultimately, if the book was, or if the movie was, a good adaptation of the book. So my first two episodes were on the Die Hard movies, Die Hard 1 and Die Hard 2, both based on books, and I think you'll enjoy it. So take a listen.
All right, so today what we're going to be doing is we're going to be talking about the book Nothing Lasts Forever and the movie it inspired, Die Hard, and I am here with BJ Cramp.
Hello.
How you doing, BJ?
I'm good. How are you?
All right. So I guess before we get started, we have to warn everybody that we are going to get into really deep spoiler territory for both the movie Die Hard and the book Nothing Lasts Forever by Roderick Thorpe. So, BJ, what is your sort of Die Hard experience? Like, I know for me, Die Hard was a movie that I really, really enjoyed from the first time I saw it till watching it again for this podcast. And I can't even tell you how many times I've watched it. So what is it about Die Hard that you responded to? And then ultimately, what made you want to search out Nothing Lasts Forever?
Well, you know, in 1988, I was 14 years old, and action movies at the time were my favorite thing. I mean, First Blood was like what maybe my earliest favorite movie. I was obsessed with Rambo. I'd seen every Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. I mean, my dad took me to see Commando in the theater, and I look back now and see how old I was.
Yeah.
And that movie's kind of famous, I think, for the largest body count at that point in film.
Yeah.
And then even, you know, I was waiting for Raw Deal to come out. My dad took me to see that. It was like, you know, it was, my dad always says about Raw Deal, he's like, yeah, I'm in the mafia. That's what my dad always said. But I can remember I would open up the newspaper movie section and I would cut out the ads for the movies and save them and everything. I was really big in the action movies. So when Die Hard came out, obviously I was going to see it. But the thing is, at the time, I hated Bruce Willis.
Well, yeah.
I knew Bruce Willis from Moonlighting, which I probably never watched. But
yeah.
And he had that terrible album, which with the horrendous Respect Yourself video. I hated all of it.
Yeah, Bruno.
Yeah. I had seen Blind Date because I loved Night Court. So John Larroquette, you know, is like the bad guy. And he's hilarious in that movie, Blind Date. But to me, Bruce Willis wasn't very good in that either.
Yeah.
So I was not a fan of Bruce Willis. So I don't really remember exactly, but I have to think that I was pretty torn about this movie at the time. I mean, it probably got a lot of press for how good it was, and yet I wasn't excited to see Bruce Willis in this kind of movie. I mean, it's hard to get the perspective on it, but at the time, Bruce Willis was not what you would expect. You wouldn't have expected him to become an action star.
Yeah, and I think ultimately that's what really works about that movie, probably.
I agree. Yeah, that's very true. So yeah, so I still remember going to see this movie in the theater. Like I said, I was 14 and my friend Paul's mom would take us to the theater, buy our tickets, and then leave and come back and pick us up later, you know, because yeah, you had to be 17 to go see the movie. So,
right.
And I still remember that we saw Die Hard and then we snuck in and saw Young Guns the same trip to the theater.
What a double feature.
Yeah, right. And yeah, Die Hard at the time felt like a revolutionary film. I remember it was like, I mean, when you saw Die Hard, you knew that after that, action movies were not going to be the same, or at least they were going to be judged on a different set of criteria, or there was going to be a different standard that action movies were going to be held to. It was like before and after Die Hard. That's how it felt, you know?
Yeah, and even if you look at like how many movies were pitched as Die Hard on something after that.
Right. Yeah.
So it came out July 15th, 1988. On a budget of $28 million, it grossed $140 million, which I guess at that time was a pretty big haul. It was directed by John McTiernan, who also did Predator the year before, which is another great action movie. And there really is a lot of great action movies from probably, you could probably track it from First Blood through, I'd say, Terminator 2, maybe.
Yeah, and Predator was another mind-blowing movie when it came out. Like, very, I mean, I loved that movie at the time. It was a huge deal.
Yeah, yeah. The screenplay was by Stephen E. D'Souza and Jeb Stuart, adapting Nothing Lasts Forever. So what was it about the movie that eventually made you want to search out the book? Because the book was out of print for about 20 years. I finally got it when they released it in an e-version in 2012.
Yeah, you know, I didn't read the book at the time, which is weird because, well, I guess it was out of print, but I read every book like this back then. I mean, I read all the novelizations. Mm-hmm. You know, I had the Escape from New York novelization. Yeah. I had everything like that.
Yeah.
But I used to go to a bookstore in my hometown that probably would have had Nothing Lasts Forever sitting there. I don't know, but I did not read it at the time. Not that I remember.
Yeah.
But I'm always looking for stuff like this to read, and just like last year, for some reason, I got it in my head to get this book and read it. It was just kind of a coincidence that when you talked about doing this podcast, I had just recently read the book.
Yeah, that was pretty cool that you had literally just read it, finished it a couple of weeks earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. One interesting thing I noticed is in the movie, they credit it as being based on the novel by Roderick Thorpe. They don't credit it as Nothing Lasts Forever. And from all the research I've seen, they actually retitled the novel when they reissued it around the time. So I haven't actually seen any covers with the Die Hard cover, but it's definitely something I'll look for. And if I uncover anything, I'll include it in show notes. So I think everybody pretty much knows the plot of Die Hard. It involves a New York City cop who is traveling from New York to Los Angeles to be with his estranged wife and her and his kids on Christmas. And she works for a corporation that is having, a Christmas party, and terrorists take over the building. And Bruce Willis's John McClane is in the bathroom freshening up, and he escapes, and he basically wages a one-man war against these terrorists. He befriends a cop along the way who he has radio discussions with, and it really has some spectacular action sequences. So I don't know if at this point we want to drill any deeper into the movie. Is there any aspect of the movie that I didn't hit that you want to talk about?
Well, have you seen the laundry list of people that supposedly turned down the role before it got to Bruce Willis?
Well, I do know that initially Nothing Lasts Forever was a sequel to a novel by Thorpe called The Detective, which was turned into a movie with Frank Sinatra. So I do know that Frank Sinatra had first right of refusal on this, and he was 73 when they pitched him, and he passed. And then I understand that it was originally going to be a sequel to Commando with Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, that was one idea. And D'Souza wrote Commando.
Okay.
Also, I read that in the early 80s, Clint Eastwood owned the rights to the book, and he at one point was thinking about making it with himself in the starring role. But it's hard to know if it's true, but I found a list that included Charles Bronson, Burt Reynolds, De Niro and Pacino, Stallone, Nick Nolte, Harrison Ford, Richard Gere, Mel Gibson, Don Johnson, Richard Dean Anderson, and I even saw somewhere Michael Madsen was mentioned.
So pretty much if you were a working actor of a certain age in the mid-80s, you were considered for this role.
Yeah, and you know, that made me think about this interview I heard recently with Matt Damon, where he was talking about how struggling actors basically, a lot of the time, they just have to wait for the role that everyone else turned down, you know? And it seems like that's kind of what this was for Bruce Willis. But I think, like we said earlier, that paid off big time, I think, for the movie studio, because I think one of the main things that made this movie so successful was the fact that it was Bruce Willis and not Schwarzenegger or Stallone.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what really sort of surprises me about hearing that a lot of people might have passed on this, because at least the finished film, The script seems really, really well executed in terms of hitting all the beats it needs to hit and also creating a hero who is sympathetic and somebody you really want to get behind as an audience, but also is able to sort of deliver those wisecracks and not have it, you know, you watch that movie now, and I watched it this morning. None of those wisecracks that Bruce Willis deliver really come off as hokey like some of the Schwarzenegger stuff from that time does when you watch it now.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
Yeah, he's not a cartoonish character, and he's not like a comic book superhuman superhero. He almost comes across as almost an average guy. And I think even though the action in the movie is over the top, I think what was different about Die Hard as opposed to like Commando or Rambo was it actually still felt realistic and almost like it could be happening to you. Like
yeah.
You didn't have to be Arnold Schwarzenegger to be in that building battling with those terrorists or whatever. It felt more realistic somehow and more relatable, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And you also, you saw the effects of what he was going through, you know, physically, you know, he looked beat up by the end of that movie.
Right, right.
So we talked about the fact that the original story, the detective, spawned the sequel, which was Nothing Lasts Forever. And I know, I don't know too much about the detective, but I do know that like many sort of books that are sequels or are part of a series, there's a couple of sections of the novel where Thorpe actually, I guess, goes through the at least high-level plot of the detective. Did you pick up on that, or do you know any more about the detective?
Yeah, I started reading The Detective, and then I kind of skimmed some of it. He does pretty much summarize The Detective early on in the book. You know, to say it's a sequel, I don't know how if you could really describe it as that, just because The Detective came out in 66 and this book came out in 79. And besides having the same main character,
yeah,
there's very little similarity at all between the two books.
Yeah.
A person who likes Nothing Lasts Forever is not necessarily going to like The Detective at all. All right. That's what I found.
And was it mostly a stylistic thing? Had Thorpe's style changed between, you know, the time he wrote The Detective and Nothing Lasts Forever? Or was it more that Nothing Lasts Forever is really sort of an action book?
Right. Yeah. Nothing Lasts Forever is completely different just because it really is an action book. The movie really did take most of its major plot points from the book. So the book really is a pretty much action packed. And yeah, The Detective is not action packed. So
yeah, and we'll talk about the differences between the book and the movie. And the one thing I found really interesting was it really seems like the writers read the book and then they were like, okay, these are the key moments that we need to keep and let's build a movie around that. And we'll definitely get into it. So let's talk a little bit about Roderick Thorpe first. He wrote 13 novels starting with in 1961 and ending in 95. He was born in 1936 and he died on April 28th, 1999. And I actually pulled up his obituary from the Los Angeles Times and it gets a little into his background. He actually worked in his father's business for quite a few years and took over after his dad retired. And that business was a detective agency where I guess Thorpe gathered, as the obituary says, the tools of the investigative trade. I came to know what about police procedure, investigative techniques, and all the rest from my father, he told the LA Times. His son in this obituary also says that he would start his books with an idea and then he would outline it on index cards and lay it out and flesh out the story. He wrote longhand up until about 10 years ago, so that would have been the mid-80s, loose leaf paper and number two pencil. So he wrote Nothing Lasts Forever on loose leaf paper and number two pencil, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And he developed arthritis, which eventually made him turn to computers. He also taught a lot more towards the end of his life as opposed to writing. And he's described as being an unassuming man who smoked plain wrap cigarettes and drove nondescript cars. He once said money probably wouldn't change his no-frills habits. He's quoted as saying, "The quality of my life isn't in shopping for gold-plated cars. I value friendship, loyalty, truthfulness, honor, you know, the intrinsics that seem to have gone by the board. I don't care whether the neighbors know I've made it or not. And that wants me to get to something that we talked about real quick in the pre-show before we actually started recording, and that was the overall theme of Nothing Lasts Forever. And it seemed like that quote right there, the quality of my life isn't in shopping for gold-plated cars. I value friendship, loyalty, truthfulness, honor. It seems like Nothing Lasts Forever tries to address a changing society that the character of Joe Leland, who that's his name in the book as opposed to John McClane in the movie, he couldn't really sort of get on board with where society was going. It just seemed like there were a handful of passages that dealt with Leland talking about his daughter and the life that she was leading.
Right.
And just overall, it seemed like Leland had negative thoughts about society in terms of not really helping each other out and being, you know, more self-serving.
Right. Well, there's one thing I definitely noticed, but it relates to the very end of the surprise ending of the book.
All right. Well, you know what? Let's bookmark that. And when we get to it, we'll talk about that.
Okay.
So I guess the main difference between the book and the movie is really the fact that in addition to the name being different, the character is wholly different. He's a licensed private investigator, and he's also around retirement age. I don't think they actually say his exact age in the book, but he's probably anywhere between, 55 and 65?
Yeah. I saw somebody who calculated it based on something, and yeah, he's at least in his 50s.
Oh, yeah, because he talks about fighting in the war.
Right, yeah, he was in World War II. Yeah, so you have to, he's at least like in his late 50s.
Yeah.
Which they make pretty clear. Yeah, he's definitely, he's supposed to be at least 20 years older than John McClane.
Yeah. In the book, another major difference is he's not visiting his estranged wife, he's visiting his daughter and her two kids, so his grandkids. And I gotta say that when you mentioned Eastwood and Charles Bronson, you know, some of those older actors, you know, I mean, even Sinatra, 10 years younger, I would have liked to have seen, not in Die Hard, but in Nothing Lasts Forever, the movie.
Right.
One of the other main things that go through this movie, or the book, I guess, is since he wasn't married, he was widowed from a wife that he had separated prior to dying. And we have a whole sequence that opens the book where he's on the way to the airport and, you know, there's a car accident with his taxi and he pulls his gun on the other driver. I guess it's all set up to get where we need to get. And he gets on the plane and he meets a stewardess who he sort of strikes up a relationship with on the flight. And he ends up thinking about her a lot during the course of the book. And he also speaks to her a handful of times through the book over CB and then through a combination of CB and TV. And I think one of the other major aspects of this book that I noticed in terms of being different than the movie is in the book, we stay with Joe the entire time, whereas Die Hard cut to the terrorists at different points. They cut to Al. They were able to break away from that character. And I think the book is really effective in the sense that you really feel like you're going along for this ride with Joe. And it's at the expense of developing other characters. I think the only other characters that are really developed in this book are probably that stewardess, Kathy Logan, maybe. But I mean, Al, the cop that he talks to on the radio, you don't really get to know him much at all. And even the terrorists, they're all German in the book. And a lot of the changes were really weird. In the book, it's Little Tony Gruber. And there's another terrorist named Hans in the book, which I guess right. The screenwriters decided to co-opt that. And then they pretty much cherry-picked right out of the book Carl, which was really interesting. Are there any other things you noticed that they changed from the book to the movie that, you know, still sort of resembled the finished product?
Well, yeah. Well, you know, he kills Carl's brother, but he has a different name.
Yeah.
And, you know, Takagi becomes Rivers, but there's still the same scene where he shoots him.
Yeah, it's Claxon Oil in the book, and they're building, or they just closed a deal to build a bridge in Chile.
Yeah, and they used Ellis, and they instead of actually catching him snorting coke, Leland just notices a rolled up dollar bill. But there's even the thing where Ellis says, "Show him the watch," and then the daughter says later. Or, I mean, that they put that right, that same little conversation in the movie.
Show him the watch. It's a Rolex.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to see all the little things that that they used, yeah.
Yeah, and one of the most important aspects they used was the barefoot Joe Leland, where it's funny, in the movie you actually see Bruce Willis on the plane talking to that businessman sitting next to him who tells him that story. In the book, we get an internal thought from Joe where he's thinking back to a story somebody told him about. For him to take his shoes off.
It was an old German man on an airplane who had known Hitler when he was a kid, yeah. But he did not tell him to make fists with his toes in the book.
You want to know the secret to surviving air travel? After you get where you're going, take off your shoes and your socks. Then you walk around on the rug barefoot and make fists with your toes.
Fists with your toes.
I know, it sounds crazy. Trust me, I've been doing it for 9 years. Yes, sir, better than a shower and a hot cup of coffee.
The other interesting thing I thought was, in the movie, they notice he's barefoot and they shoot out the windows, whereas in the book, they figure it out at some point, I guess because they see that he left his shoes behind, and they break light bulbs in the stairwell. And he really, really gets screwed up. One of the major differences between the character, for me, aside from his age and his profession, is really how beat up he is by the end of this book. He really feels, or he's described as having gone through a war.
Yeah, I think a big difference between Joe Leland in the book and John McClane in the movie is Leland is much more knowledgeable and adept, and like he notices things as he arrives at the building. He's already suspicious. He sees the car and the truck.
Yeah.
And he knows who little Tony is as soon as he sees him. The Hans Gruber character, he knows who he is and he knows all about him. He knows his MO, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a whole sort of flashback sequence where he talks about a conference on terrorism that he had gone to.
Right.
And that was another thing that I really liked in the book, and I'm not sure it would have translated to the movie, but the fact that Leland is really dealing with, as he calls them, kids, but he also, through a lot of the book, he really wants to kill these people. And there's even one point where after Gruber is pretty much dispatched, he kills in cold blood a female terrorist who was still alive.
Right.
And you couldn't do that in the movie because you'd hate Bruce Willis, but I thought that was really interesting. And I also thought there was some really interesting differences between that first kill, whereas in the movie, he gets in a fight with Carl's brother and they roll down the stairs and Carl's brother breaks his neck. Whereas in the book, he decides he's going to break this guy's neck and he describes how he does it. And he breaks the guy's neck. Whereas in the movie, it's more of a sort of an accident, which I thought that they got to the same result two different ways. Another big difference between that first kill is the note that he writes on the guy's shirt. In the movie, he says, "Now I have a machine gun." In the book, he writes, "Now we have a machine gun." And it was interesting to see how Joe is trying to create confusion and indicate that possibly there's more than just one man out there. And that even extends to choosing which weapons to use.
Right. And I think the way he kills Carl's brother compared to the book and the movie, I think that's a big difference between the Leland and McClane characters is a lot of what happens for John McClane, it feels like it's just luck.
Yeah.
Whereas Leland, it feels like it's like most of it, he's meticulously planning everything and you're in his head. So you hear all of his thoughts. And yeah, you know, when McClane kills Carl's brother, it's just pure luck that he broke his neck when they fell down those stairs.
Yeah.
Whereas Leland, it's a very calculated thing that's described, you know, so.
Yeah. Do you think that they could have translated that aspect of his character over sort of that I don't even know how you describe it. It's not vengeful, but very sort of bloodthirsty. I mean, I'm not entirely sure how to describe it, and I think that's probably why they changed the character. But do you think there's any aspect of that they could have carried over, or would it have not worked?
Yeah, I think they could have made John McClane a little less bumbling and a little more knowledgeable, or, you know, put his police training or whatever more to use than he really does.
Yeah, he never really seems flat out angry, whereas in the book, there's sections where Leland is very, very angry, and that sort of drives what he does.
Yeah, I got the feeling that the more he felt that his daughter was threatened, the more angry he got, you know?
And actually, that reminds me of another huge detail in the book. His two grandkids are hostages.
Right, yeah.
So one of the things we talked about is how they sort of hit all of the key action scenes here, and it was just done differently in the movie in terms of how they got there. We have the whole sequence where in the movie Bruce Willis is moving in the elevator shaft, and he uses the gun and the strap to sort of hoist his way down. In the book, if memory serves, he does that on his own time, whereas in the movie, he's being pursued by Carl and two other guys.
Yeah, and he uses a strap from a backpack or something instead of like the strap Bruce Willis used was actually like the arm strap or the sling that was already attached to the gun. Yeah.
Yeah. Another big sequence that was carried over was where I guess they're blowing up the RV in the movie. In the book, there's no RV, but there's a huge firefight on the ground, and Leland has the plastic explosives that he commandeered from one of the dead terrorists that he killed, and he basically drops a computer monitor with some plastic explosives on a chair down the elevator shaft, blowing things up. That was almost a direct lift from the book.
This under advisement, jerkweed. Geronimo, motherfucker.
Let's talk a little bit about the terrorists, because in the book it's clearly defined that there are 12 of them, and he pretty much tracks them and knows them, and he dispatches just about all of them. I think he gets 9 of the 12, maybe even 10 of the 12, whereas in the movie, there seems to be a lot more of them. And I think the book was really effective in showcasing how deadly Leland was, whereas in the movie, like you said, McClane sort of bumbles his way through at points where Leland was really driven, and he was meticulously taking these guys out at certain points. Another thing I wanted to talk about was the Ellis character, where, as in the movie, they make Ellis sort of implicit. I don't know if implicit's the right word, but they make him implicit in his own death. Whereas in the book, he's really not developed at all. Do you remember any differences between the Ellis murder or death in the book as opposed to the movie?
Yeah, well, the character in the movie is so obnoxious.
Yeah.
And, just begging to be shot. Mm-hmm. And so, and also seems so clueless, incredibly clueless. And, yeah, you know, Leland doesn't like him in the book either, because he suspects that he's having a relationship with his daughter, and he saw the rolled up dollar bill.
Yeah.
But they don't make the character out to be as much of a douchebag as he is in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, he really is sort of, in the movie, he's sort of drawn as like that 80s yuppie that nobody likes.
Yeah, and I read that the actor ad-libbed when he said, "Hans, booby."
Yes, that's on the Blu-ray set, yeah.
Hans, booby.
So there's a couple of things that happen in the book that don't happen in the movie at all, and that's, there's a character that he talks to and that helps him out throughout the book named Taco Bill, who is sort of a guy on the CB who is giving him information from the outside and even hooks him up with Kathy at one point. I thought Taco Bill was interesting, and I would have liked to have seen him worked into the movie somehow.
Yeah, definitely.
And also, Al in the book He's a 22-year-old sort of rookie cop. Whereas in the movie, you know, it's Reginald Bell Johnson from Family Matters. And he sort of given this story where he was he didn't have the stomach for street work anymore because he had shot a kid and he vowed he'd never use his weapon again. And he has this whole arc where at the end of the movie he ends up shooting Carl, which is what he does in the book. And I guess that was really one of the Hollywood aspects of translating the book, is you have to find those moments where you can give these other characters an arc and make it more meaningful that Al shoots him at the end of the movie. Whereas in the book, it's really kind of a throwaway moment. Carl and Joe do not have any interaction in the book, whereas in the movie, they have that huge fight where McClane hoists him up on that chain and leaves him for dead. Another sequence that translates directly over from the movie was where McClane's on the roof and it's about to blow up and he has to jump off and he uses a hose. Whereas in the book, it's set up a lot differently, where the terrorists pretty much trap him on the roof.
Right.
And he's forced to sort of find his way down. And I thought it was interesting that they still found a way for him to have to use that hose. And they did it in a much more dramatic fashion involving the blowing up that FBI helicopter.
I promise I will never
even think about going up in a tall building again.
Oh, God, please don't let me die.
That helicopter landing is also in the book.
Yeah.
And he tries to stop them from doing it the same way.
Yeah, in the book they use a rocket launcher, though, don't they?
Right.
Yeah,
right,
I think they sort of combine the RV and the helicopter.
Yeah, you're right. You're right, yeah. That's what they did. Yeah, the RV in the movie is the helicopter.
Yeah, and they don't blow the roof. So really, in the book, they're sort of these radicals that disagree with the fact that this oil company is basically providing arms to the corrupt government in Chile. And they really just want to make them pay for that. And they're stealing $6 million in the safe, whereas in the movie, it's $640 million worth of bonds. And the hostages come into play because they really need them to get away with that amount of money. We also, at the end of the movie, we get the gun gag where he tapes the gun to his back, which is another thing as you're reading the book. If you've seen the movie, you're seeing it set up and you know where it's going. One thing you don't know where it's going is how the climax of the movie plays out in the book. And I know we said we were going to bookmark that. Are we at the point where you wanted to talk about that?
Sure. Well, I wanted to, going back to when Carl, you know, Carl's final appearance in the movie, which is kind of like the movie trope where they have to have that last shocking scene that is really kind of annoying to me.
Yeah, because how did he survive that? The building's, you know, exploding. He's hanging on a chain. Bruce Willis shot him a couple times.
Yeah, and so they want to make you think they have the music playing and it's all over. Everyone's fine. And all of a sudden, here comes Carl. But in the book, that scene does happen. But did you notice that Powell pulls Dwayne Robinson into the line of fire?
Yes.
He actually describes it that way.
Yeah. And that was the cop in the movie played by Paul Gleason.
Dwayne
Robinson. Yeah. So in the book, that character is shot.
Pretty much the same character in the movie as in the book. The police captain who keeps yelling at Joe Leland.
Yeah.
And telling him, you know, to just let them handle it and all the same kind of stuff.
Yeah. And at the end, as Powell says, he takes a bullet for Leland.
Yeah. Powell actually uses him as a human shield. But it's funny how it's just kind of said in one sentence where you're like, wait a minute, did he really just, you know, the way he describes him as pulling him into the line of fire, but you have to stop and think, yeah, that means he pulled him on purpose into the line of fire, but it's pretty I almost wish they would have done that in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. That would have definitely, I think, changed people's perception of the character. And that's another one of those Hollywood things where, oof, you know, I, like I said, it's as much as I love Die Hard, I'd be really, really interested in seeing a truer adaptation of Nothing Lasts Forever. And I don't think we ever will, but it would definitely be interesting because I think the novel really spoke to sort of the fact that you can be older and still be of value and still provide support when needed. So let's get to the end of the movie as opposed to the book where we have Gruber holding, in the movie it's Holly, in the book it's Stephanie, who actually is married to a guy named Gennaro. It's not her maiden name in the book.
Right.
What happens in the book is Leland shoots Gruber. He tells Stephanie to get away. She decides to not, and her and Gruber both fall to their death. Am I missing something in how those events played out that led to Stephanie actually falling with him?
Well, the reason that he pulls her out the window is because he holds on to her watch.
Yeah, which is a gag in the movie.
Right, right, yeah. But there's, you know, there's the scene at the beginning where Ellis says, they say that they just closed this big contract, and that's the contract with Chile with which Gruber is pissed off about, I believe, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, Ellis says, show him the watch, and she says later, but the watch is like the symbol of sort of the corrupt corporation. So when Gruber pulls her out by the watch, I was thinking that's a symbol. You know, if she didn't have that watch, she would still be alive.
Oh, wow. That's an amazing, amazing connection you made there. I love that.
Yeah. So it's almost like she was killed by her own greed and corruption.
Yeah.
In the movie, he even says it's a Rolex. And they don't actually point that out in the book. But,
yeah,
you know, the watch is her reward for her part in that deal.
Yeah.
And it eventually leads to her death, basically. So.
Right, right. And in the book, the terrorists were going to drop the money on the streets.
Yeah.
Which is what Leland ends up doing.
Yeah.
Out of view. And as we alluded to, there is still, as described in the book, a 20-year-old girl, terrorist, who's still alive, who he flat out executes. And she pretty much gets blamed for dropping the money. Another slight difference is at the end when Carl comes out, before Al shoots him, of course, as you said, Robinson gets pulled into the line of fire, but also Joe gets shot there in the thigh.
Right. So you were talking about that you felt there was sort of a theme.
Yeah.
Does what I was saying about the watch, does that sort of play into what you were talking about?
Totally. That definitely plays into it. And I'm sorry I didn't make that connection because it definitely deepens my appreciation for the novel, which I've now read two times at this point. And I got to say, my overall feelings on the novel is I think it's really a good read. It's an action movie in book form where you're able to get in the character's head. And it's really a man who is dealing with regret about the relationship he has with his daughter. Regret about the relationship he had with the wife that he lost before she died. But then also the hope that he has in this, you know, this new potential relationship with Kathy, the stewardess that he met. I think it's a really interesting book, and I really enjoyed reading it a second time. And it's surprising that you're able to create different mental pictures reading the book, even having seen Die Hard. There was no point in the book where I thought Bruce Willis while I was reading it. And I know everybody reads books differently, but how did you find the experience reading it in terms of creating your visuals?
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that, but you're right. You're not picturing Bruce Willis when you're reading this book. It's a very well fleshed out character that you feel like you know in the book. So yeah, I definitely was not picturing Bruce Willis at all. I love the book. What's really unfortunate is that I can't possibly enjoy this book as much as it should be enjoyed because I had seen the movie.
Yeah.
And you really, really wish that you could be in a situation or a reality where you could read this book knowing nothing about it, knowing nothing about the plot, but you also want to be able to see Die Hard.
Yeah.
It's like you can't, you either can't enjoy Die Hard as much or you can't enjoy the book as much. I guess it's one or the other, but
yeah,
I often feel that way. Sometimes it's a dilemma about whether I want to read the book first or see the movie first, but I usually will go for reading the book over seeing the movie. But yeah, this was impossible with this book, and it's just unfortunate. So it's hard to really even gauge how much I would like the book if I just approached it not knowing anything about it and not having seen a movie based on it, you know? But I think it's a great book, and I would definitely recommend it.
Yeah, you only get those handful of surprises where they deviated from the book. But I was really shocked reading it on how much really carried over. I didn't think it was going to be as literal of an adaptation as it was, because a lot of times I thought maybe they were just going to take the concept of an office high-rise being taken hostage and a guy sort of fighting them. I know there's not much you can do within that framework, but I don't know. I just didn't think it was going to be as true to the book as it was. Now, in terms of, and I'm not sure we're going to be able to really define this or not, but do you think that this was, let's call it a successful adaptation?
You know, if I had read the book first, if I can try to think in those terms, it's hard to know how I would have felt about it. It definitely doesn't achieve sort of the tone of the book.
Yeah.
And it's kind of too much of a Hollywood blockbuster. You know, like you were saying, you would like to see a more literal adaptation of the book because, yeah, the movie is, in the end, is very different from the book, even though pretty much all of the major plot points, all of the memorable things from the movie pretty much all came from the book.
Yeah.
But it's a very different character, very different main character. And yeah, like we were saying, Leland is much more knowledgeable and well thought out, whereas the John McClane character is more of a comedic character and more just lucky more than anything.
Yeah. I'm going to say I think that the screenwriters here, D'Souza and Stewart, I think they succeeded in taking a book that had certain aspects in it that wouldn't translate to the movies and made it a movie that could be released in the summer in 1988. I'm not sure that means that it's a perfect adaptation, but I think with what they were probably tasked with from the producers, and one of the producers was Joel Silver, he of Lethal Weapon fame, I think they probably delivered the script that he wanted. So I think in terms of achieving what they were supposed to as screenwriters, I think they succeeded. But I think overall the movie probably falls a bit short in terms of being a successful adaptation of the book. And I think the main thing going against it is right out of the gate, that 20-year age difference.
Yeah, that is a major part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Leland, he has kind of a mysterious career path there. You know, he went from being a police detective to a private investigator, and now I think he describes himself as a security consultant.
Yeah.
And he talks about these seminars he does, and he seems to be, I don't know, you almost get the feeling that he's connected to something similar to the CIA or something like that even.
Yeah, definitely, because there's one point where he doesn't want to give away his name on the radio, and he gives the name of somebody to contact who can fill them in on what he does. I really like the Joe Leland character, and I think you said that you would recommend reading the book. I would also recommend reading the book, even after hearing our discussion here with all these spoilers. I still think it's a well-written book. There were a couple of passages where I can't remember the exact quote, and I should have highlighted things in my Kindle when I was reading it, but he talks about viewing the mountains and saying they stood there ready for the next 10,000 years, which I thought was such a good line, which really sort of indicated how meaningless we might be on this planet. But yeah, so I really am glad that I eventually read this book, and I'm glad they reissued it, because I think a movie like Die Hard, when it has source material, it should definitely be easy to find. And I'm glad that it's now available. And I think on Kindle, it was pretty cheap. I think I got it for maybe $7. Either way, it was something that I was so happy to see and really enjoyed reading it.
Yeah, I think you can get it from the actual book for like $9 or something on Barnes & Noble. So
Yeah. Very, very cool.
Yeah, it's definitely a well-written book. And I saw that it got really great reviews at the time it came out. It's a really well-written, well-conceived book. And, you know, they did make a good movie out of it. They definitely made a good movie. And those two screenwriters, I looked up what else they did. And D'Souza, Stephen D'Souza, he wrote Hudson Hawk as well. And then relating to your other podcast, Jeb Stuart wrote Lockup.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You guys are doing. Is that the next one you're doing?
Yeah. Next month on Slycast, we'll be talking about Lockup. I'm not sure when this is coming out in relation to the Lockup episode, but we might have talked about it by the time this episode hits. So that's very cool. Let's see. And I guess, is there anything else you wanted to talk about Die Hard or Nothing Lasts Forever that we didn't hit during our discussion?
Let me look at my...
Yeah, I think I hit everything in my notes.
Except for my Bonnie Bedelia story.
All right, well, let's hear it.
Well, I looked up, and Bonnie Bedelia, she was 7 years older than Bruce Willis.
Oh, okay.
And I was just wondering why they cast her in the movie. I don't know. But do you remember the movie Presumed Innocent?
Yeah.
Yeah, she was Harrison Ford's wife in that movie.
All right, and Harrison Ford's probably closer to her age.
Yeah, and my friend and I, there was a movie theater where we grew up called The Pix, which it was one of those theaters that got the movies after they had their run in the theater, and so it was like $1.50 to go see them, so we would just pretty much go to every movie, but it was downtown where it was basically a movie theater and then a bunch of bars and a bunch of semi-homeless people wandering around, and it was one of those movie theaters where literally your feet, no exaggeration, stuck to the floor. Like, you had to peel your shoes off the floor.
I miss those theaters.
Yeah. And so we would go to every movie there. So we went to Presumed Innocent there. And one of those guys from the bars came wandering in probably halfway through the movie, sat down in front of us. And there's one point where Bonnie Bedelia was in like a negligee. And we were teenagers, I'm not sure, probably around the same time as Die Hard this was. And that guy turned around to us and goes, "Luscious tatas." And so that's my Bonnie Bedelia story.
Oh, that is too funny.
You don't have to put it in, but...
Oh, it's definitely staying in, BJ.
And also at that same theater I don't remember what movie we were seeing. One of those guys walked in the middle of the movie and walked up to the front and stood in front of the screen and just started singing the Twisted Sister song, Burn in Hell. So it was always fun to go to the Pix and see movies.
Oh, man. BJ, this was a really cool discussion about Nothing Lasts Forever and Die Hard. And I want to thank you for sitting down with me. And I know that we plan on sitting down to talk about other books that inspired movies along the way. So this will definitely not be the last time we talk.
Cool.
So again, thank you. And I know that before we leave, I want to talk a little bit about your podcast, and it's called Rock and or Roll. Do you want to give us the pitch real quick?
Well, it's a podcast for real rock and roll nerds who want to hear about bands and hear music that they probably have never heard of before. That's mainly what I try to do, because I've been obsessed with music my whole life and have a huge music collection, and if I'm obsessed with all different kinds of rock and roll, from power pop to heavy metal and punk and glam rock and everything else. So I cover just a lot of different stuff and play a lot of really obscure songs, all stuff that I really like a lot. So it's just a lot of music that you've probably never heard before, but you know, if you're really interested in rock and roll and the history and all the different bands that have existed over time that never really got the attention they deserve, maybe, or you know, I mean, I don't know if most people, I think, don't even realize how much great music is out there that never got any attention. I mean, there's so much great music that a lot of it is turning up on iTunes now, but until just recently, there was so much great music that really was never even available digitally on CD or anything.
Yeah.
But more and more of that stuff is popping up on iTunes now. It's pretty crazy how much stuff is.
Yeah. And it's also really amazing to discover something that has already happened. Yeah. And it seems new and fresh to you.
Yeah, I mean, even me, who I've spent, you know, 20 plus years obsessively tracking stuff down, and I still find out about stuff all the time that I didn't know about. There's so much great rock and roll out there. You know, I'm mainly obsessed with like 70s, 80s stuff. Yeah, it's just, it never ends, really. If you're a big music fan like me, you still never run out of stuff to track down. So
yeah, yeah. And again, that podcast is called Rock and or Roll, and I will include all the pertinent links to it in our show notes. So, BJ, one final time, thank you so much for sitting down and having this chat on the first episode of this podcast, where we're going to be talking about books or stories and the movies that they inspired. So, thanks again, BJ.
Thank you, Craig. I will take any opportunity to babble about movies, books, music, whatever. So I enjoy it.
All right. I will definitely take you up on that. And we will talk to you next time.